been the traditional practice of rabbis throughout the generation to treat the portion of the week as a source of insight and inspiration for all the current problems of the day. And indeed, every portion of the Torah, even a portion of the Torah like Tazria or Niseo, can serve as a source of insight for all the current problems of the day. This is true of every portion of the Torah. It's a kalohemra that the portion of the week that was read by all Jews less Shabbos can serve as a source of insight and inspiration on all the problems of the day. A story is told of a certain Magid who had only one drosha on Parshat Keirah. He had no other drosha, and he was invited to address a congregation on another Shabbos. Tazria Miseo. The Magid, for a moment, he was baffled, confused. He didn't know what to do. He only has a drosha on Parshat Keirah. He can't speak on Keirah, on Shabbos Tazria Miseo. So he thought for a few moments, and then he thought of a connecting link. He had, as a Magid, in those days, so he had in his pocket a box with tobacco, pushke tabak. So he deliberately dropped the box of tobacco on the floor, and he said, Rabbi Isai, the pushke tabak is gefallen zu der Erde, to the Zeele Kerach. Mit deiner Idee ist ein eingeschwungen geworden von der Erde. Und nichts der, als ich auf den Mund wegen Kerach, Kerach, Kerach. So that story shows that even those Magidim who had nothing to say on any portion of the week, but on Kerach they had. So in a certain sense, I'm very fortunate, because I was invited to address the convention of the Rabbinical Council of America on a Tuesday after Shabbos Keirah. So it goes without saying that I'll base my thoughts upon an episode in the Sedre that we read last Shabbos. Now the Torah tells us that after the Jewish Shalom meted out a very severe penalty against Kerach, we are not saying Kerach, and the princes in Israel, the 215 individuals who were of world renown, the Rebbeinu Shalom said to Moshe, as it is mentioned in the Sefer, Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe l'emor, Daber el bnei Yisrael, ויקח לי איתום מטה מטה לביסוב ויזכור מציעיהם ולביסוב שנימוסו מטה איש ששמוי תכתיב על מטה ושם הארוי תכתיב על מטה לאיב כי מטה אחד וריש בית הבית והנחתום בירמי לפי יועדוס אשר יבואי את לכם שם ומייתי גאטו במושה to take words from the head of each tribe. And for the tribe of Levi, he should take the rod from Aaron. The Hoyo Yish Asher Efcha Boy, Mateyu Yifcha. And the one whom God chooses, his rod will block. And Moshe picked out, he complied with the command of God. He took rods from the heads of each tribe. And for the tribe of Levi, he took a rod from Aaron, the rod on which Aaron's name was inscribed. And he left the 12 rods in the Eil Meid, in the tent of meeting, overnight. And behold, in the morning, Vayovi Meshe Eloedus, Vini Porach Mate Arein Levi Slevi, Vayetzi Terach, Vayotzi Tzi, Vayid Moshkei. Moshe beheld that the water baron budded and the blossom blooms and the bore fruit, the emin fruit. Now the question arises, this episode was as miraculous an occurrence as the manner in which Kerach ve'Adose perished. This episode of a rod of wood overnight budding and blossoming and bearing emmons infringed upon the laws of nature. From the Gemara in Chum Davov, the story of Rav Pinchas ben Yoyir, it appears that Almighty God is reluctant to infringe upon the laws of nature. The reason being that the laws of nature themselves represent the will of God. To infringe upon the laws of nature means to run counter to the will of the Almighty. Only a very important emergency can justify the violation of the laws of nature. We can understand as to why the Rebbeinu Shlomo violated the laws of nature in meeting out the severe punishment against Korach and his associates, in order to show that Korach and his associates were wicked, Moshe and Aaron were righteous. But why was it necessary for the Rebbeinu Shlomo to meet out this additional miracle of making a rod blossom and bear fruit? What could be accomplished by this mess? And if nothing could be accomplished by this miracle, so how is it that the Rebbeinu Shlomo infringed upon the laws of nature, which in themselves represent the will of the Almighty? But this death took place for a very important purpose. It is true that the nest that was wrought in connection with the perishing of Kerach ve'Adose pointed out beyond the shadow of a doubt to all of mankind that Kerach ve'Adose were wicked, Moshe and Aaron were righteous. But Kerach raised an argument against Moshe. He raised the argument, why should Shevet Levi be elevated over and above the other tribes in Israel? The whole community of Israel, he says, is holy. Korach's time was that the elevation of one Shevet above other Shevet, the elevation of one family, Mishpachat Aaron, above other families, is undemocratic. It's not in consonant with the concept of Chaverim Kol Yisrael, Koloido Kulom Beishi. Why should there be an inequality? Kerach was a Rosh, but he raised a very cogent argument, and he deserved an answer. What is the answer to this question? Why then should Shevet Levi be elevated over and above the other Shvat? The miracle that was wrought in connection with the budding and the blossoming and the bearing of fruit by the rod of Aaron had as its direct aim to give an answer to Korach's challenge of Koloid or Columnation. True indeed, that Koloid or Columnation, all Israelites are holy, but they are degrees of Kedusha. There is Kadesh, and there is Kadesh Kadosh. Koloid or Columnation all the Shvatim in Israel are Shifti Pure. They are all of the Ishim. But Shevet Levi and Aaron, Mishpachas Kehune, are Kodesh Kodesh. Why? What makes Shevet Levi elevated over the world, the other Shvatim, who are also the Ishim? But David HaMelech, in the chapter of Mizmor Shir Yom HaShabbos, pointed out very poignantly the criterion whereby one can determine real righteousness vis-a-vis spurious righteousness. When David says in the chapter of Mizmor Shir Yom HaShabbos, the righteous person shall flourish like the palm tree. It will grow like the cedar in Lebanon. For many years, I was baffled by this metaphor. Why is the righteous person compared to the palm tree? There is a passage in the Torah, Ki'od HaMikasodet. According to Rashi, it is Bithio, but according to the Ibn Ezra, it is Binechusen. That the human being is analogous, is to be compared to the tree in the field. But why did David choose this metaphor of the palm tree? But about 18 years ago, when I made a trip to California for the first time, and at that time, I was not accustomed to fly the way I am now accustomed, and I was even afraid, as Hatoya Animali, I was afraid to fly. I knew that I could get to California in 4 hours, 5 hours, and by train it would take me a whole day, but I was afraid to fly. But I had to go to California, so I went by train. And as we traversed, as the train traversed over the extensive terrains of the California desert, the conductor pointed out to beautiful palm trees that were growing on the desert land in the California and the Nevada terrains. And at that time, it flashed in my mind the significance of the metaphor employed by David of Tzadik Katomo Yivroch. At that time, it flashed in my mind that David meant a truly righteous person is one who can morally and spiritually flourish and progress even on spiritually desert land, just as the palm tree. And when I returned home in New York, I made research. I looked up in the Encyclopedia Britannica and I took out the book on trees, and I found out that the palm tree is the only tree that can flourish, that can grow on desert land. Other trees cannot. Why? Because a tree requires certain favorable conditions. A tree, in order to grow, requires a propitious soil. On desert land, trees cannot grow. There couldn't be any process of photosynthesis on desert land. In order that a tree might grow, it requires sunshine, it requires soil, it requires water, it requires certain minerals. It cannot grow in a vacuum. But a palm tree also requires all these conditions. How is it that a palm tree can grow abundantly on desert land? So the answer is that the palm tree strikes its roots very, very deep, more deeply than any other tree. Other trees that do not strike the roots so deeply cannot grow because without water there cannot be any growth. But the palm tree, in view of the fact that it strikes its roots very, very deeply, so it gets access to water deep in the earth. The palm tree is able to have access to water. Then I realized the significance of David's metaphor, in Mizmor Shir Yemashabos, Tzadei Katomo Yifo, Ki Erez Balvonon Yifo. A truly righteous person is not the person who can be righteous in an environment that is conducive to righteousness. There are many people who are righteous as long as they are subjected to an environment that is conducive to righteousness. When I was 12 years old, not yet bar mitzvah, my family immigrated into America. My father, Zechen Ulbroche, had immigrated before, but my mother and the rest of the family immigrated later. So, on our trip to America, we stopped off in Berlin for a number of days. And that was just a year before Hitler usurped the power. And as I was not bar mitzvah yet, but at that time I thought that the Germans are so civilized, are so nice, are so democratic. They appear to be much more democratic and much more tactful than many Americans. Everyone seemed righteous. And I'm not saying that they were not righteous. I suppose that the average German in those days, before Hitler, Yimach Shmei, usurped power, were democratic and were nice. Under the Weimar Republic, there was democracy, real democracy, not spurious democracy. For the moment Hitler, Yimach Shmei, usurped the power, then the same people who appeared so nice and democratic and tactful and respectful, they changed overnight. Why? Because it is easy to be democratic and tactful and polite in an environment that is conducive to democracy, to righteousness. Under Weimar Republic, so all the climatological prerequisites for democracy were present, but once the Germans were exposed to a hostile regime, so then they changed. And this is the meaning of Tzadei Katomo Yifo. That was the purpose of the nest that was wrought in connection with the budding and the blossoming and the bearing of Ammon by the Lord of Aaron. Because an answer had to be given to Kerach's argument of Koloedo Kulom Deishin. True indeed, Koloedo Kulom Deishin. But there is a difference between Deishin and Kadesh Kadoshin. One can be a Kadosh as long as he is subjected to an environment that is conducive to Kedusha, that is conducive to Yirat Shamayim, that is conducive to Torah. But the same person, when he's exposed to a hostile environment, when he faces a challenge, when he's given the alternative between fighting and yielding, then it's not so easy. So Shpochevet Levi, they were Kiddush Kodashim. They were able to flourish and to progress spiritually and morally, even in face of a hostile environment. They were Tzadei Katomo Yifo. Now a rod is wood. A rod of wood represents a heretofore, an integral part of living organisms, of a growing tree. But the moment you sever the trunk and you detach it from the propitious soil, then it cannot grow. Then it embarks upon a process of decadence and rotting. But in the place, they were able to grow like a plant, even when they were detached from the spiritually propitious soil, even when they were not exposed to spiritual, intellectual, and mild sunshine, they were still able to grow. This is the reason as to why the Rod of Aaron, the Rod of Aaron, which represented a heretofore integral part of a living tree, but at the present it was detached from a propitious soil, it continued to bud and to blossom and to bear fruit. And there was a nes bisoichnes. Chazal in Zoite speak of nes bisoichnes. Not only was the rod of Aaron capable of budding and blossoming and bearing fruit, but a peculiar phenomenon was beheld. We know that the budding and the blossoming process takes place, and then the germination of fruit, the bearing of fruit. In natural phenomena, in natural growth, the birth of fruit means the death of flowers. You cannot have germination of fruit and blossoming at the same time. Here, every Jew beheld a very peculiar phenomenon. The rod of Aaron, at the same time that it budded, it blossomed. At the same time that it blossomed, it bore fruit. What did it show? The blossoming, the budding, and the blossoming stage is symbolic of beauty. The bearing of fruit is not necessarily beautiful, but it's vital. Beauty might appeal to the aesthetical sense, but one cannot live on beauty, on visions of beauty. But fruit can serve as the source of the foodstuffs that are indispensable for living. Shevet Aaron, in face of a hostile environment, was able to grow, to bear fruit, and be beautiful at the same time. That is the true test of righteousness, of vision. And it behooves us to delve into each detail of the nest. Now it was an egg, so the Rebbeinu Shalom could have manipulated that some other fruit should grow on the rod of Aaron. Oranges could have grown, grapes could have grown, olives could have grown. Why dafke emen? Why dafke emen? But I think that there is a purpose in making the rod of Aaron, as Goch had a direct purpose, in making the rod of Aaron bear dafke the emen fruit. The emen fruit, I think, I'm not a botanist, but I think, I have a vague impression, that the emen fruit, the emen tree, is the only tree that manifests itself in two varieties. We have sweet emen, and we have bitter emen. A truly righteous person, Shevet Levi, deserves to be elevated over and above the other Shvatim, because Shevet Levi and Mishpachas Aaron, Mishpachas Akihani, were ready to bear bitter fruit. It's very pleasant to bear sweet fruit, because everybody enjoys it, and everybody compliments you when you supply him with sweet and pleasant fruit. But it's not pleasant to accommodate people with bitter food. One who finds it necessary sometimes to accommodate people with bitter food, that's the true test of genuineness, of righteousness, of gdushe, of yirat Hashem. A person who likes to accommodate people all the time with sweet food, well, he cannot be a genuine leader. He can only be a spurious leader. At the end of Parsha Bishalach, the Torah tells us, Vayovei Amalek, Vayelochem Yisroel Yofili. וינם מישל ישוע חלונו אנושים ויצא ילוחים בעמולי מוחו אונויכי ניצול על ריש הגיבו ומטה לקימיון ויאסי ישוע כאשר אומר לי מושה וילוחים בעמולי ומושה אבין דחו אולו ריש הגיבו והויו כאשר יורי מישה יודי בגובה ישראל וכשיוניח יודי בגובה רמולי וידי מישה כבדים ויתחו אבן ויוסימו תחתו וישב עליו ואבין דחו תומכו ביודו מזה אחד ומזה אחד ויהיו יודו אמונו עד בוי השם בגמורים יומה tells us in connection with the expression say the Yerochim ba'amori mochor on the Mechimitzo al Reish Adibo isi ben Yehuda inaya zeu echod min ha'ksuvim shel Mohecha ba'kosu. When you examine the written text without the aid of the Masoret, you couldn't even know how to read the pasuk, because it can be read in two ways. One way of reading the pasuk is Seivi lochem ba'amolei k'mocha Oneichin nitzov al reshagim. So one way of reading the word mocha is by linking it with the preceding word Seivi lochem ba'amolei k'mocha. Another way of reading it is the way the Masoret tells it. Seivi lochem ba'amolei in a sachar mocha oneichin nitzov al reshagim. In the written text, there is no indication how to read. But the Masoret guides us and tells us that we have to read it Seivi lochem ba'amolei, it's not mocha. We have to read the struggle against Amalekism right now. So then we can strive that mocha, the next day, will be victorious. But if one will postpone, he'll procrastinate the struggle against Amalekius to tomorrow, then he cannot hope ever to proclaim the victory over Amalekius. There were many Jews sincere in the course of generations. In every generation, I would say, there were certain segments in Jewry who, while they agreed that the struggle against Amalekius, and as the Nitziv points out, this parasha of Milchomo Ladishem Ba'amolek Midei Adeya is to be distinguished from the parasha of Amalek at the end of Kiteite, because the parasha at the end of Kiteite deals with the struggle, the war that has to be waged against the nation of Amalek. But the parasha in Bishalach does not deal with the struggle that has to be waged, the war that has to be waged against the nation of Amalek. There is no nation of Amalek. There are new nations have spawned out, but the ancient nation of Amalek has disappeared. So how can the Torah say Milchomo Ladishem Ba'amolek Midei Adeya? So the Nitziv in Hamidomo says that the parasha in Bishalach, when it says Milchomo Ladishem Ba'amolek Midei Adeya, it does not have reference to the war that has to be waged against the nation of Amalek, but rather the war that has to be waged against the ideology of Amalek, against the ideology of brutality, of violence, of idolatry, of vulgarity and profanity, hypocrisy and corruption. This milchama has to be waged midei adei, without a pause. So there were many segments in Jewry, almost in every generation, who, while considering that the struggle against Amalekius, against idolatry and profanity and violence, bloodshed, corruption and hypocrisy, has to be conducted, but it has to be postponed. We are too weak to fight. You can't fight heavenly hope. How can you fight corruption? So the Masoret tells us, no, we cannot read the pasuk Seivi lochem ba'amolek mocha, but Seivi lochem ba'amolek right now mocha on the chimika al reish agivo. Now, to say that the struggle against Amalekius has to be conducted right now, it cannot be postponed for one moment, that requires guts. This is bitter hemmings. and Kibbutz Levi was elevated above all the Shvatim, because Kibbutz Levi realized that we cannot say Tevi Rochim Ba'amolik Macho, but Tevi Rochim Ba'amolik. And then again, we see a very important insight in this parasha in connection with the struggle that we have to live against Amalekius in all forms. The Torah in this parasha says, V'dei meishek reidim, v'yikro eben v'yosimu tachto, v'yeshev olel, v'yavim v'chu, tomchu v'yodov, mizeh od mizeh. The question arises, why does the Torah have to say, tomchu v'yodov, mizeh od mizeh od? V'yavim v'chu, tomchu v'yodov. Naturally, it means, mizeh od mizeh od. There is no superfluity, there is not a superfluous letter in the Torah. Here, a number of words appear superficially to be superfluous. The Torah could have said, "Umeishe ve'arin v'chu tomchu v'yodov." So what does it mean, tomchu v'yodov? So naturally it means mizeachot mizeachot. Why does the Torah have to spell it out, mizeachot mizeachot? But what was the reason as to why Aaron and Chu were chosen to support Moshe's hand? This parashah, Al-Fidin, has reference for the future generation. And there is a halach in Shulchan Aruch that whenever the tzibur is gezer itayni, so then, and the shliach tzibur has to say special prayers on yema tayni, so the two Jews have to stand, one on the right side and one on the left side of the shliach tzibur, because of the adin v'chu otom chub yodok mizeh achot mizeh. When best Nizizer Atainis, why is that Nizizer Atainis? As children. So this is the primary means of struggling against Amalekius, improving our own ways. How can we start struggling against others for Amalekius when we ourselves are not pure? So the first step in the struggle against Amalekius consists in mending our own ways in doing tshuva. So when the struggle against Amalekius takes place, then the Torah says, V'arim v'chu tomchu v'yodov mizeachot mizeachot. Moshe is the symbol for all the spiritual leaders throughout the generation. Every genuine spiritual leader can be a leader or fail as a leader, depending whether he tries to draw inspiration from Moshe Rabbeinu. This is the reason as to why Chazal called every Talmid Chochem Meishe. Meishe Shabir Talmid. One who doesn't try to draw inspiration from the Anoga of Moshe Rabbeinu in his own, that he too should emulate Moshe's ways in his own little way, he's not a spiritual leader. He's a spurious leader, not a genuine leader. So whenever a spiritual leader is to conduct a struggle against Amalekius, then it must be supported by two individuals, Aaron and Hur. Aaron, everybody knows, was the symbol of Sholem, of peace, of Havas Abrid. Eiv Sholem, the Eiv Sholem. Hur was the symbol of something else. I'm afraid to mention a name because it's a horrible word today. Kanoyes. So instead of Kanoyes, I'll use another expression, firmness. Steadfastness. If the word kanoyes is a horrible word, all right, but firmness, steadfastness is not a horrible word. So Aaron was the symbol of love, of peace. Hur, on the other hand, was the symbol of steadfastness, of firmness, of proper obduracy and stubbornness. Stubbornness for a principle. When the Moshe of every generation, when a genuine spiritual leader starts waging a war against Amalekites, against idolatry and against profanity, against violence and against corruption and injustice and brutality, then he must be motivated by two separate concepts. On one hand, he must be motivated by the paramount principle of Shalom, peace, and Havas Abrias, Havas Yisrael, Havas Abrias, love of Israel and love of mankind. But at the same time, he must also be supported by another concept, by a concept of kanoyes, of firmness, of steadfastness, of persevering obstinacy in respect to principles of Yigei Badia Zohar. Should not yield when a principle is challenged. Arin and Zohar, both together, have to support the spiritual leader, have to motivate and guide the spiritual leader in his struggle against Amalekites. So someone will say, but how can these two concepts, which are a divergent poles from each other, motivate the spiritual leader? It is hard to disaster. They are diametrically opposed to each other. So the Torah tells us, no, they are not diametrically opposed to each other. They are in the chur, some chubiyodov. Don't think that there is any inconsistency between Sholem and Kanoyes. It all depends what kind of Sholem we have in mind, what kind of Kanoyes we have in mind. But if it is the Kanoyes that emanates from truth, then it goes hand in hand with Sholem and Avat Abris. And when a spiritual leader is most pleased, and on the other hand, the midah of Kanoyes, of firmness, of steadfastness, of persevering obduracy and stubbornness in respect to principles, then we are sure that we will not postpone and procrastinate the struggle against Amalekites, but will embark upon the struggle against Amalekites right now. And then we can also be sure that Onechin Tzofal Reisha Dibor Umate Elekim Biyom. And in conclusion, I would like to mention a very beautiful story from the Gemara in Yomim. Gemara in Yomim that from Zion. Kino Nikono Nase Nisim with Losoiso Gohoyu Matirino Isoi Vishvach. Nicanor was a Jew who lived the time of the Second Temple, the Second Temple, and miracles were what in connection with the gates that Nicanor tried to bring over from Alexandria Shel Mitzrayim to Eretz Yisrael. Tonu Rabbono, Mani Sin Naasu Vidlo Seiso Omu Kishoholach Nicanor. We hope in Losei from Alexandria Shom Yitzchai. Vachas the Losei Omad Olof Nachshil Sheveyam Litovei. When the Connor needed certain gates for the eastern side of the temple, he went to Alexandria Shom Yitzchai to transport these gates. And on his return, a gale arose that tried to drown the boat with Nicanor and the gates. Not Lachas Mehen, the passengers and the boat, they decided, in order to save their lives, they decided to cast one gate into the sea. Not Lachas Mehen, with the Lua Liam, Vadayim Lino Chayom Mizape. They thought that by casting one gate into the sea, so that would lighten the burden so much that it would not be in danger of drowning. But it wasn't so. The gale continued. Bikshu lehatiles chavato. So then they were passengers, or perhaps the captain himself. They said, no, we have to cast down into the sea the other gate. But what will be the Bisamigdos? The Bisamigdos will not be able to exist without gates. But we have to save our lives. What could they do? Pikuach Nefesh. Omadhu Nikonei girded himself with courage and strength. Vikocho. And he wrapped himself, he tied himself together with the other gates. Omalan, Atiluiva, you want to cast the other gate? All right, I can fight you, but you'll cast me together with the other gate into the sea. I will not allow the other gate to be cast in the sea. If Comer had been an American, he probably would say, he wouldn't use such a refined expression. He probably would say, over my dead body, you'll throw the other gate. But he wasn't an American. So the gale subsided. Once he showed this degree of Miseras Nefesh, of saying that he is ready to be cast into the sea together with the gate, then the gale subsided. So then he realized, if I had shown that same courage when the captain decided to cast into the sea the first gate, then the gale would also have subsided. So he felt very aggrieved by his heretofore cowardice. When once he arrived at the harbor, Shalako, the harbor of Akko, Hoysomi Batveses, Vietsomi Tahadevne Hasrina. When he arrived at the harbor of Akko, so he noticed that the first gate that was cast into the sea was trying to break through its way from under the walls of the boat. And the other gate was also restored. What our sages like to tell us, it's not just a story about today. It's reflective of the challenge that was presented to Jews throughout generations. There are three gates to Yahadus. One gate is the gate of Gilus Hasodim. One gate is the gate of Aveido. The other gate is the gate of Torah. The gate of Gnus Hasadim, fortunately, has remained intact. Why? Just as an assault was made on the gates of Avodah and Torah, so, and even more so, an assault by Saint Yisrael was made against the gates of Gnus Hasadim. The same Israel throughout the generations were more concerned with the dedication of the Jews to Gnus Hasadim than for the dedication of the Jewish Tabeda. An anti-Semite does not mind so much that the Jew puts on a pound still, but he might object very much when there is solidarity among Jews, when there is solidarity between American Jews and Israeli Jews. This he cannot stand. But putting down the touch, he doesn't care. An assault was made, a real assault, was made by the Israeli Israel against the gates of Gnus Hasadim. And they tried to impress upon Jews many times that in order to lighten their burden on account of the terrible gale that is facing us, it is necessary to cast the gate of Gnus Hasadim into the sea. Shouldn't be attached to Israel so much. After all, we live in America. It's double loyalty. But fortunately, Jews from all circles, most assimilated Jews, conservative Jews, reformed Jews, have shown that's shown without any exception. I'm not talking about isolated exceptions, renegades. I'm not talking about that. But there is no segment in Jewry, even among the assimilated Jews and informed Jews, who did not show unimaginable Mesiras Nefesh on behalf of Yilas Hasodim. And the gate of Yilas Hasodim was saved, was preserved. But when the Jews immigrated into this country from the European towns, and they were faced with a hostile environment, and they found that the land of America is a spiritually desert land. You cannot plant on a tree, spiritual and moral trees. The only tree that could be planted is the palm tree. But they refused to plant palm trees. They refused to plant almond trees. They refused to eat the bitter almonds. And they decided the gate of Avoda has to be cast into the sea. We have to adapt ourselves to the times. We cannot continue struggling against everybody, against Reformed Jews, Conservative Jews, Assimilated Jews, against Fatah, American Jewish Congress. It's too difficult. We have to lighten the burden. Otherwise, the Jewish boat will rock, it will be drowned. And they cast, a few decades ago, American Jews cast the gate of Avoda in the sea. But then they thought that by casting the gate of Avoda into the sea, then the burden will be lightened, and thereby will be able to preserve Torah in America. But what happened? The gale did not subside. And it continued. It continued to wax. This gale of assault. And now we are faced with the challenge that there are certain segments in Jewry, unfortunately, who are trying to impress upon us that in order to preserve the gate of Yud HaKadosh, in order to save Israel, we must allow these segments to cast the other gate into the sea to save Israel. But our answer must be, save Elohim b'avolik miyad. We have to say, as Nikona said, no, they cannot cast the gate of power into the sea. It is very sad indeed that Jews, Orthodox Jews, Torah Jews, a few decades ago, allowed the gate of Avoda to be cast into the sea. Now we dare not allow the other gate, the gate of Torah, that it should be cast in the sea, but we should gird ourselves with courage and strength, with the same courage and strength the Jews have shown in the War of Independence and the Milchemet Shishit HaYomim and Milchemet Yom HaKippurim, in respect to the gate of Yilas HaSodim. We have to show this in a flourish, and we have to tell the Reformed Jews and the Assimilated Jews, the World Jewish Congress, Dr. Goldman and his associates, if you want to cast the gate of Torah into the sea, then you'll cast us with it. And then it will show this Mr. Stefesh. So I'm sure that not only will we be able to save the gate of Torah, but even the gate of Avoda that was already cast into the sea a few decades ago will be Mivatzetes, and it will be preserved, and we'll be able to have all the three gates of Torah of Avoda.